Hello, good evening, and welcome to Seascapes. On tonight's programme, we pay tribute to the adventurer, filmmaker and author Tim Severn, who died recently, and we have the latest from the Vendée Globe solo round the world race. Tim Severn was a world-renowned adventurer and author. He undertook numerous expeditions on various historical craft, most notably in the footsteps of St. Brendan the Navigator, who crossed the Atlantic in the 6th century. Tim died just before Christmas at his home in West Cork, aged 80. In a moment, I'll be speaking to a close friend of his, but first, let's hear from Tim Severn himself, speaking here to Eamon Dunphy on RTE Radio. In this clip, he tells how he came to live in West Cork and about the Brendan voyage.
Was living in London in a literary, you know, like other, like the classic sort of writer, in a garret in London. And I came to Ireland on, I took advantage of an Aer Lingus special long weekend offer, which included ticket and a rent-a car.
And in those days, it must have been about 1,500 quid.
Well, it was, I came across and they could have thrown in a hotel or the rent a car, and actually I took the rent a car and slept on the back seat and drove around the coast of West Cork, and I saw the village of Courtmacsherry, and I thought, this is just terrific. And I went in to the pub and I said, would there be anybody who, in, you know, would there be a chance to buy a house here? The place was very run down, and I got the look which said, which house do you want? Everyone was leaving, and the thought of somebody arriving in was a total surprise, and it was the best thing I ever did.
And what attracted you, apart from the beauty of the place?
It was cheap.
Yeah. And the people are beautiful people down there.
Just amazing. I learned that if you carry with you the attitudes that pertain in West Cork, you can go anywhere in the world, whether it's Mongolia, Patagonia, remote Pacific islands.
What attributes do you think they are?
Judging a person for what they are. A level playing field. A sense of humour. All those. And, even if you're sort of in Mongolia and you don't really speak the language, you establish connections and you can find your way. And I used to just kind of refurbish that, if you like, every time I went home to West Cork.
Yes, and it remains your home.
It does, absolutely, yes.
Now, the Brendan voyage seems to me remarkable for many reasons. One of the biggest ones for me, or the most important ones for me, is it's dangerous.
Yes, it was the most dangerous of the projects. I was actually a sailor, I have to say, by then. I'd taught myself to sail, and I'd actually had a little 27-foot sailing boat, which taken right down to Turkey and things like that. But I wasn't an expert sailor, and I would hasten to say I'm still not an expert sailor. It was extremely dangerous. I would never recommend anybody do it again. We've made our point, and it's we. I don't do these things solo. It's always with a team. And there were really four of us on the really dangerous section, which was out from Iceland across to Greenland in the Denmark Strait. And
tell us which myth you were exploring. I know Irish monk.
It was the story of St. Brendan. He and a group of monks set out to find the promised land, and they build this boat of oxhides, and they sail from the west coast, and they have various adventures, and they stop at various islands where they meet other monks. And it sounds very much as though it's the Celtic sea journey up the coast of Scotland, up to Faroes and up to Iceland, as far as Faroes, there have been, hermit cells have been found, traces of Irish settlement. Never beyond there, though it was, there's literary evidence that they got to Iceland. I wanted to show that there was a physical possibility that the promised land that they reached was actually North America, because they had the boats, a boat of the type they had could make the journey. But behind that, and this is where you look at the myth, St. Brendan has various adventures. He encounters a column of crystal floating in the sea. Sounds like an iceberg. He comes to an island where hot rocks are thrown at him by a man who emerges from a cave, a sort of troll figure. Sounds like Iceland volcanic explosions. But there was, you know, the most famous picture of Brendan, he's landing on the back of a whale. Now, it's illustrated in medieval books. And it was kind of scoffed at slightly. But, you know, in Brendan, which was kind of banana-shaped, it was leather-covered, it looked a bit like a whale, it had no engine, it floated along very slowly. The whales were intrigued, and they would come and sort of virtually nuzzle up against the boat. So this was something that, until you put it to a test and you were out there, you didn't realise actually this could well be how this idea of the friendly whale, Jasconius the great fish, is how the medieval text describes this great whale that comes back and helps them.
Tim then spoke about the type of people who joined him on his adventures.
All sorts. I must have, close on 200 different crew members.
How do you advertise for them?
They just find me. They tend to just show up at the dockside. And I just generally will say yes, because I find that virtually everybody has got the ability to do one of these trips.
What do you look for in a companion on an adventure like that?
Sense of humour. Relaxed. The dangerous ones are those who are too keen. My boats go very slowly, and they also disintegrate very slowly. So you just have to keep a sense of perspective. It's not, you mentioned earlier, you know, people climbing mountains. This is not a competitive activity. You're not seeking to conquer something, you know, to reach the North Pole or the greatest depth of water or whatever. You're actually testing a theory and you're learning from it.
Dermot O'Mahony is the former cox of the Cormac Sherry lifeboat and a longtime friend of Tim Severn. Dermot told me earlier about his arrival in West Cork, where he was to live for more than half his life.
Well, Tim, he was actually travelling from Kinsale, heading west, further west into West Cork. And as he came over the hill in Harbour View, he saw the beautiful village of Cormac Sherry in front of him. And he couldn't believe what he saw, really. Such a colourful place and such a lovely harbour and all. So he decided, rather than carry on west, that he turned off at Timoleague and came down to have a look at Cormac Sherry. And he fell in love with the place right away, really. At the time, there was a house for sale here, and he bought the house. It's only about 5 doors away from my own home. He came to live there then in the early 1970s. And he was along here then when we had the rumours about him planning the voyage. And the next thing that arrived in was there was a curragh. He started practicing with that out here in the harbour and in Cormac Sherry Bay as well. And then, of course, we heard that he was going to get a boat made of leather to sail across the Atlantic.
Old hands at the sea like yourself there must have thought he was being insane. A leather boat across the Atlantic.
Yeah, we couldn't believe it was possible, really, to be honest, you know. And I'll always remember then, the winter before, the boat was built in Crosshaven. It was done quite quickly, actually, to be honest. You know, it all happened quickly enough because we thought this would all be away in the future. But he got going about it. And she had built in Crosshaven Boatyard, and the harness maker, John O'Connor from Cork, was very involved with doing the leather work with him and that. She did arrive anyway, and she went out here for the year before, for the winter before he set out on the voyage. A lot of his crew would be here coming and going. I remember George Maloney, you know, he was the sailmaster, and another man was Arthur Mangan from Hoth. There was a man from the Faroes came. I think there were a few different crew members came and went. I remember one day anyway, they were out in the bay. It was the day after St. Patrick's Day in 1976, and it was blowing hard from the east. And my mother had a post office here at the time, and Tim would use the post office an awful lot, obviously, at that time. And his wife came in that morning, and she said to my mother, "I'm very worried about Tim out in the bay. and it was a bad morning, all right. And remember my sister said to me, well, if she's worried about him out in the bay now, what will she be like when he's crossing the Atlantic? But see, he did it nonetheless, you know, and he achieved it, which was a marvellous achievement, really.
He was completely integrated in living in West Cork.
He was, actually. He really loved the place, you know. And to our surprise, he told us his favourite time in Kirkmaishery was January, probably the time we would least enjoy here, really. And the reason he did that was because of all the wildlife here and that. Yeah, he really made it his home, like, and he made us really appreciate our own place a lot more, to be honest, you know. And before that, we were saying he thought this isn't probably all he's expected it to be, but yeah, he just enjoyed it all. But he enjoyed the simple things of life, really, I suppose.
He was on the lifeboat crew when you were cox?
Before I was coxswain, really, I suppose, yeah. He actually made, what he did was he was out in some exercises, but he didn't actually go out in any calls, but he did make himself available. If he was available, he said he would go if we were short. But he was a great supporter of the lifeboat and of all things local, really, you know.
Through all his adventures, other adventures, you followed him avidly from Cormac.
Yeah, of course, the other one, we had a big game, which he did a lot of practice here for, but he retraced the Crusades. And he had two horses, you see, one very big horse who came from the Ardennes in France, where it's a famous place for these very powerful horses. And he had a smaller pony as well. Now, while he was here, he was training for a long time with those two horses. And I'll always remember the day that he was to set out to leave Kirkmaishery with the big horse. It was on a Sunday. And he gave the whole day trying to coax the horse to go into his little horse trailer. You see, and no way would the horse budge, as if he sensed what was happening. No, he was quite used to going in the trailer before that, and it might take him to other places and all that for exercises. But he gave the whole day, and he wouldn't budge. And eventually, about 5 o'clock in the evening, of his own accord, the horse just went into the horse box without anybody saying anything to him. And of course, away he went. But that big horse, he never survived the Crusades, funny enough. And he got, I think then they continued, then they got a pony, a Connemara pony. And the Connemara pony survived. Yeah, I love it.
He was a very modest and unassuming man. He could have been world famous, but he didn't seem to want that.
No, he was very much dead. And, you know, he's very much dead, down to earth. And I think a lot of that might have come from the fact that he was born in India and raised in India. And I think you would notice that trait a lot in the native Indian people. They would be really very unassuming and a lot of them that I found.
You held a funeral for him just before Christmas. Unfortunately, he had to be socially distanced.
Yeah, it had to be, yes. But then... Of course, he lived in Timoleague, you see, when he left Kirkmaishery around the 1990s. And it was there he passed away. So the funeral was from Timoleague, and some of the lifeboat crew put a guard of honour on the bridge out of Timoleague, again, keeping social distance as the funeral passed.
You, for one, are going to miss him.
Oh, yeah, we will, because, you see, the funny thing about him, you know, he was... a lot of people are asking me, when did he leave here? But it was very hard to know when he left, because Tim would say he was gone, and the next thing he'd be back again. You see, and even when he did eventually leave, because he was only living 5 miles away up beyond Timoleague, every now and then you'd think you would see, the next thing he'd appear again. So he always kept coming back.
Diarmaid O'Mahony paying tribute to his friend, the late Tim Severn. And I'd like to pay tribute here to a man who's retired after 45 years of service to the Baltimore Lifeboat, which was adjacent there to Kirkmaishery. Kieran Cotter, who's been on the programme many times, stepped down as cox just earlier this month. The best of luck to him in his future, and best of luck as well to the new cox of the lifeboat, Aidan Bush. The Brexit deal signed off on Christmas Eve has been hugely criticised by the fishing community here. Lorna Siggins has been gauging some reaction, as she first spoke to Kilmore Quay scallop skipper Seamus Molloy, who says that Ireland needs to get more quota back from the EU.
I seen the Taoiseach yesterday. He's looking for progressive ideas to in the future to help remedy what's going on. And I think it's probably one of the first times that he's asking questions maybe from the right people, and it's time to get ideas in place and see what we want and make sure we get it. I mean, and I start with a minister for fisheries. I mean, we're an island nation and there's no minister for fisheries. I mean, there should be someone from the minute he gets up in the day till the minute he goes to sleep at night wondering how we can get back what we've given away. I'm sick of people telling me that we gave it all away in the 1970s. Well, it's not the 1970s anymore, and we're still giving away. It's time to start taking back. There's a bluefin fishery that's on our doorstep. We see them when we're fishing every day of the week. It's a massive fishery. They say they're endangered species, but yet the EU quota has risen from 12,000 tons to close on 19,000 tons in the last 4 years. They're running in Irish waters for 4 months of the year. And believe it or not, we have a zero quota. Zero. I mean, zero quota with 20,000 tons. I mean, this could be a big fishery, and a big fishery for the southeast area, and a big fishery for tourism as well. I'm sure you've seen plenty of programs where people pay a lot of money to go out and chase tuna and try catch one. Well, to me, decommissioning is not the answer. I mean, all they're doing is getting rid of the jobs. I mean, 20 years' time, when the money's spent, the jobs are gone and there's still no fish. And that's and no access to our own waters, and that is the problem. We've decommissioned before, and we end up with a smaller fleet, and we end up with less. And we provide 10% of EU waters. And when you put it into context, France only provides 8%. In actual fact, we provide 10%, but it's close around 30% of the fishable waters. It's where everyone wants to be.
Arthur Reynolds is founding editor of the Irish Skipper magazine and a former BIM board member. He's now based in Norway.
Every day, planes fly Norwegian fish to Japan and planes fly to America with Norwegian fish. And that is a potential for Ireland that we must relate to and visualise. Don't forget, the only island member of the EU, we don't have Germany's huge car industry. We don't have France's wine industry. For us, it has to be the sea. This, of course, is going to bring us into conflict with our fellow members, particularly with Germany because of its investments in the Spanish fishing industry. It's also going to lead to a balance in relation to the changes in agriculture. The Norwegian fishermen highly respect the skills of Irish fishermen, and they know where in conditions that Irish fishermen work in are often extremely tough. So they cannot understand why, when we have this access as a coastline, that Ireland can't be as rich as Norway.
And it's an issue we'd be coming back to again and again. The leaders in the Vendée Globe solo round the world race are entering the final stages of their adventure. Before the start in late November, we spoke here to one of the favourites, Alex Thompson, on his boat Hugo Boss. Unfortunately, Alex has been forced out of the race. Today, Andy Robertson from the Vendée Globe headquarters told me about how things were going for the rest of the competitors.
Well, the leader is just about 550 miles to the east of Buenos Aires in Argentina just now, and the back markers are still to the west of New Zealand. So it's a big span, but no more than usual for this race.
What is the difference between the leader and those at the back markers? The boat?
It's a whole combination of things, but really the whole of the Vendée Globe is, and the speed is very much dictated by the weather systems that all the different sailors have to play with, if you like. And so in this particular case, it's been pretty difficult for the leaders. We're about 7 to 8 days behind the record pace at the front, and that's all to do with the speed and the difficulty of getting down out of the South Atlantic in the early part of the race. It was very slow in the west of the Pacific, just after New Zealand. We had about 5-6 days over Christmas when it was a big high-pressure system dominating the fleet. And it was very, very slow then. And consequently, I'd say we're about 6 or 7 days behind the record pace.
Is that reflected as well in the number of people still in the race? We had 33 started, there were 27 left. It seems a very large number, given the usual casualty rate.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think there's a combination of things there. One thing for sure is the boats are almost certainly more reliable because it's harder to get into the race. There's a qualification process involved where the boats have to do a certain number of races in the Amoka Globe series. And so the boats are theoretically better tested. But also we didn't have very big storms in the Bay of Biscay on the after the start, which is quite often where we get a large casualty rate. But in general, I think the boats are a little bit better prepared, and you know, that seems to be making a difference. And the skippers, indeed, you know, the skippers are, have done more miles.
The leader is Yannick Besthaven. He just has just under 6,000 miles to go. It seems right, incredibly quickly.
Yes, I mean, he's an interesting one because he would be considered to be a little bit of an outsider, but he's got a very reliable boat, and he's really his program's been very carefully put together with some very, very smart people, and he's just been consistent all the way through. He's had no major damage, whereas Thomas Rioong in third and Charlie Dallin both had to stop at different times to repair damage with their foils.
People in this country were very disappointed that Alex Thompson was forced to pull out in South Africa.
No, I think there's, you know, he was one of the favourites for the race. You know, we had a big, big following all around the world, so I think everybody's disappointed that Alex is out, and likewise, Jeremy Bayou is one of the big favourites in France, and he had to restart 9 days later, still in the race and doing a great job. But for sure, the race misses both these major favourites.
What happened to Alex?
Well, Alex had some structural failures in his bow area originally, and that took him a few days to repair, which he did. But then he hit some fishing tackle, I think, some kind of fishing hardware in the water, and knocked out his rudder, and there was no way of coming back.
And even in the wilds of the Southern Atlantic and Southern Pacific, floating flotsam is a danger.
Oh, massively. I mean, we had one particular area just to the south of South Africa in the Agulhas Current where there seems to be a lot of flotsam and jetsam in the water, shipping containers, sea mammals, just principally because of the meeting of the currents there. But that seemed to be a particularly bad area where we had three or four boats having damage there.
There was also dramatic footage on the Vendée Globe website. You had one competitor whose boat effectively broke in two.
Yes, that's right. We had PRB, Kevin Escoffier. Nobody really knows what happened to his boat, but he basically nosedived into a wave, and the boat effectively, as you say, broke in two and sank within a matter of minutes. He had to evacuate into his life raft, and Jean Lacam went to rescue him. He saw him initially, and then lost contact with him, and then Kevin was in his life raft for 11 and a half hours before he was rescued again by Lacam, and then he was with him for several days before he was evacuated onto a French Navy ship.
When do you expect the first competitor to finish?
We're thinking towards the end of January. We don't have a specific date just now, but probably 26th, 27th, maybe a little bit later, maybe a bit earlier.
And that'll be in France?
That's right, yes. I mean, it starts in Le Sable d'Olonne, finishes in Le Sable d'Olonne, non-stop, solo, unassisted. And I have to say that the finishes are one of the most spectacular things I've ever seen in sport, because, you know, you have a tiny, tiny little dot of a sail comes over the horizon and comes back to Le Sable d'Olonne, having left there 3 months ago.
Andy Robertson from the Vendée Globe headquarters. And that's it for Seascapes for this week. We're back at the same time next Friday. Everything on the programme is podcast, and it's on our website, rte.ie/seascapes. If you want to contact me or the programme, the email is seascapes@rte.ie. And as a tribute to Tim Severn, we're going to end with some of the magnificent music from the Brendan Voyage. This piece is called Water Under the Keel.